We're going to start the show not talking about shopping, actually. Instead, how about some more money coming into our bank accounts? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, December 26th. Good to have you with us. We're getting close to the end of the year, and that means some changes. Starting next week, workers who earn the minimum wage will be getting a raise, if that is they live in one of dozens of states, cities, and counties that have opted to boost the legal minimum. The federal minimum wage set by Congress will remain where it's been since 2009 at $7.25 an hour. State and local governments set their own minimums by ballot initiative, state law, and city ordinance, and increasingly through annual cost of living adjustments, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Of the 47 states, cities, and counties raising their minimum wage for the new year, roughly half will do it automatically, based on the Consumer Price Index. They include Florida, Ohio, Seattle, and San Jose. Yannette Lathrop at the National Employment Law Project says annual cost of living hikes allow legislators to
make sure that the wages, once they are passed, are not eroding due to inflation.
It's also good politics, says economist Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation. While minimum wage hikes tend to be popular among voters of both parties, they're often opposed by business lobbyists and Republican lawmakers. So making the annual wage hike a routine administrative function,
it enables legislators to not have to delve into a controversial issue on the minimum wage.
Automatic inflation adjustment can be a problem for employers, says Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute, especially in places where the minimum wage is already $13, $14, or $15 an hour.
It's hard to imagine many businesses being able to absorb that cost only through higher prices, higher productivity, reduced turnover. So they're going to have to turn to the size of their workforce.
21 states still follow the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, which has lost more than 15% of its purchasing power to inflation since it was last increased in 2009. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you're still going through your holiday gifts, think for a moment about how they got here. Chances are good some of them or parts of them traveled at some point by ship. 90% of global trade happens over the seas. And continuing with the theme of new year, new regulations, the costs of that shipping are about to go up. Starting January 1st, a United Nations agency will require all ships in the world to reduce their sulfur pollution. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, the cost of complying will filter down to you and me.
Right now, ships burn a sludge-like fuel that generates most of the world's sulfur pollution, causing haze and asthma. But the new rules in January will force ships to cut sulfur emissions by 85%. If you're a ship owner, one way to comply is to burn cleaner, pricier fuel, says Jamie Webster at the Boston Consulting Group.
Your fuel costs are probably going to be 50 to 60% higher, and obviously shippers are going to be interested in trying to pass those costs on till it gets down to those of us at the consumer level.
How much more things will cost is up for debate. One flat-screen TV may cost less than a dollar more to ship, according to one estimate, but a week-long cruise could run an extra $150. In cleaner fuel, one main ingredient is diesel. So Webster says ships will be competing for diesel with other users.
Trains, if you've got a diesel car, the FedEx and UPS trucks that you see driving in your neighborhoods. So that could actually increase the price of diesel
by up to a dollar a gallon, by one estimate. Now, all this assumes that shipping companies obey the new rules and don't cheat. Analyst Rusty Brazil is with RBN Energy.
There's also a big question about how much cheating will be involved. There'll certainly be some. There's no police force out there enforcing all of this. It's being essentially enforced by the companies that fuel these ships.
So the new emissions rules for ships will bring unpredictability. One thing reasonably clear is that the world's air should get a little cleaner. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street was back in business today and setting new records. We'll have the details and, yes, some retail news when we do the numbers. Saudi Arabia is the world's largest exporter of oil, and that's been enough to drive the country's economy for a long time. But now Saudi leaders are trying to diversify the economy, and one way to do that is by encouraging entrepreneurship. The recent Saudi Aramco IPO was aimed at funding this economic and social transformation. The BBC's Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, has been meeting some of the young Saudis, particularly women, navigating the shift.
Manar Alamadi's idea has been for an app that provides Arabic newspapers, books and magazines as audiobooks. It's taken her on a more risky route than Saudis have been used to in the workplace.
It is very hard to confront your family, to confront your mother, your father, who have already drawn the path for you. Like, my mom doesn't know anything about entrepreneurship. She was like, why are you leaving your governmental job? Stay there.
This is a change that long-time observers have been surprised to see put into practice in Saudi Arabia. New pop-up businesses have been sprouting up in the capital, Riyadh, where live music and street food have become normal. For 16 years, the business analyst John Svakianakis has been observing Saudi Arabia from within.
Society wouldn't be so energized to think about how to create alternative sources of revenue other than oil or working for the public sector. So entrepreneurship was not something that young people were thinking of. And this is a different story happening today.
No expense spared events like the MISC Global Forum have been used to sell this new vision of Saudi Arabia. The organizer of the event, Shaima Hamidadeen, recognizes the new opportunities being presented to women, but stresses her belief, shared by many, that this is not a total break with the past.
Prophet Muhammad married his first wife, who was an entrepreneur, a businesswoman that was older than he was. And she never changed who she was after she got married. She was a mother. She was the breadwinner. So I'm always inspired by that.
The economic changes are aimed at the country's under-30s, who make up some 70% of the population, no longer guaranteed nor seeking government sinecures, and with unemployment a major problem, they're being encouraged to make their own futures.
Adventure is right outside your door.
One of the institutions at the forefront of these changes is KALST, the science and technology university that was founded a decade ago with the aim of reviving the Arab world's once leading role in the sciences. Sara Al-Aid has used her research there to set up a business to try to tackle the problem of food waste.
It's amazing to see like girls and young men here to be able to have their own company and like work on what they're passionate about.
Those opportunities are drawing some Saudis back home, like Ala Balkhi, a fashion designer and social media influencer who's been living in the US for years and sometimes feels the rapid pace of change has left her lagging behind her Saudi-based friends.
I think there's more opportunities for me here. New York is so saturated. And it's so busy, and New York is New York. But Saudi right now is the time where things are happening.
The shadow hanging over all this optimism and dynamism remains the imprisonment of some of the most high-profile activists who fought for the rights that Saudi women are now enjoying. The dilemma is that both the reform and the repression that mark this new Saudi Arabia have the inescapable imprint of the most powerful man in the country, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Young Saudis put their faith in his vision, as much as many commentators on Saudi Arabia fear and distrust the impulsive flaunting of his power. In Riyadh, I'm the BBC's Sebastian Usher for Marketplace.
In the 1980s, American cities were in a state of crisis. Crime rates were high, downtown businesses were closing, and many jobs and longtime residents were moving to the suburbs. These days, though, a lot of those cities have made a big comeback. They're full of restaurants and shops and small businesses. Penn State University professor of history Andrew Sandoval Strauss says there's a particular group of people we should be thanking for that, the millions of Latino immigrants who moved into American cities while Anglo-America was moving out. His new book on the subject is called Barrio America. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
When we talk about the revival of the American city, not all, I should say, but many American cities over the past several decades, the creative class gets a lot of the credit. Young urban professionals, wanting to live in the city and have a walkable neighborhood and cool restaurants and coffee shops and the like. Why do you think this story hasn't been told?
Well, I think it is easy to recognize well-to-do people as a desirable customer base, as desirable tenants. But folks forget that 2 to 3 decades before urban professionals and the creative class began to return to the city, economists will say that really, it's only after about 2000 that you saw a net gain in these kinds of white-collar and highly trained professionals. But for decades before, Latinos moved into neighborhoods that most people had moved out of. And so it wasn't quite so noticed as the sort of downtown coffee shop hopping, wine bar patronizing newcomers, because a lot of people who work in the media don't necessarily live in and around barrios, they just sort of weren't necessarily witnessing this. I should say that on Spanish language media, the vitality of barrios has been much more noticed.
Hmm. At the same time that immigrants were coming in from Latin America, a lot of businesses were leaving cities. You talk about the era of Walmartization of retail. Why do you think businesses opened by these Latino entrepreneurs were able to thrive when other small businesses couldn't?
I think one of the reasons is that business worked differently in Latin America. Things like independent fruit stores, independent bakeries, which had been subsumed in Anglo-America into the supermarket, but which still existed in Latin America as carnicerías, as fruterías, and as panaderías. So that really worked very well in terms of repopulating a category of retail space that was being abandoned in Anglo-America. I think the other key factor is that they had a local population wanting to do business in Spanish. So they had very high customer loyalty. And since there were so many people clustered in these barrios, that was the perfect opportunity for entrepreneurs to satisfy that demand.
You talk about what came to be known as Latino urbanism, which really changed the cityscape, the public sphere in these neighborhoods. There were some physical manifestations of this.
Absolutely. Well, Latino urbanism is a term that has been used over about the past 15 or 20 years to identify a particular set of behaviors and customs that people from Latin America and people descended from people from Latin America tend to create in cities. The single most important factor there is that they're much more likely to walk around as opposed to drive. And as capital, investment, and retail moved out of cities, it was precisely this local walking population that really brought a certain kind of vitality back to the streets. One other key element here is that their use of the front yard of their properties was quite distinctive. They tended to put fences across the front of their properties so that there'd be somewhere for the kids to play. So the parents and grandparents would sit on the stoops or look out the windows, and it made the street much more active and much more social. And we know that when there are a lot of people keeping an eye on things on the street, that tends to drive down crime, which might be one of the best explanations as to why, as we have observed, crime is lower in immigrant neighborhoods.
In the book, you focused on two neighborhoods, Little Village in Chicago and Oak Cliff in Dallas. And there's a twist at the end of the book, which is that in some ways they've become so successful, they're becoming unaffordable for Latino immigrants now. What do you think these neighborhoods might look like, you know, in a decade or two?
Well, urban professionals are paying the barrio their highest compliment by gentrifying it. So, for example, at the northern end of Little Village, you've seen sort of a coffee shop recently open. You see that prices are going up. In Oak Cliff, property owners are being offered very large sums of money for their stores. And it's tempting for them because they can make a lot of money just by saying, okay, I'll sell to you at five times what I paid. The problem is, of course, if all of the businesses have all their customers move away, that's going to mean that the streets just don't have that same vitality or that same feel. But I should also add that in a lot of the kinds of areas where yuppies kind of come in and live, they require a whole bunch of services disproportionately dependent upon immigrant labor and especially Latina and Latino immigrant labor.
Andrew Sandoval Strauss is author of Barrio America, How Latino Immigrants Saved the American City. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've got an excerpt from the book on our website. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up.
It's a rather safe and possibly, dare I say it, even corporate choice.
The color of the year is all business. But first, let's do the numbers. Back from the Christmas break, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 105 points, 0.3%, to close at 28,621. The NASDAQ gained 69 points, almost 0.8%, to finish at 90.22. And the S&P 500 added 16 points, 0.5%, to end at 32.39. All new records, by the way. Retail sales for November and December were up 3.4% from last year, according to MasterCard. Most of that shopping still happened in person. But online shopping hit a record high, up almost 19%. Amazon said more people than ever used its Prime service this winter. Shares packaged up 4.4%. Sales in department stores were down 1.8%. But still, Nordstrom ticked up 1.8%. Macy's wrapped up 2.6%. JCPenney jumped 4.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This is it, folks. Just a couple of days left in this decade, which means time is running out to support Marketplace and make it count for this year. Any donation makes you a Marketplace investor and a partner in our mission to make people smarter about this economy. And don't forget, if you give at least $60 or a monthly donation of $5 or more, you'll get exclusive access to our 2020 Ask Me Anything virtual event series. Find out more and donate at marketplace.org. And thanks.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. We talked earlier in the show about some of the big changes coming in the new year because of new regulations. Other changes might be self-imposed. That's right, 'tis the season for New Year's resolutions. Some of you might be pledging to eat a little better, for example. With that in mind, we bring you the latest installment of our series, My Economy, this one from our partners at the BBC.
My name is Fiona Houston. I'm the founder and CEO of Mara Seaweed. We're a Scottish seaweed company that is selling seaweed flakes and powders to use as a healthy alternative to salt. From startup to now has been a complete roller coaster, because when I first started, came up with this idea of the company, there was, you know, you couldn't get locally sourced seaweed. So I literally started getting my wetsuit on and harvesting the seaweed myself. And I went to the local landowner and said, can I harvest seaweed off your shoreline? And second of all, can I park a 40-foot shipping container in your farmyard? That's how it all started. And then now we're, we have a technical kitted out food processing facility. So it seems in 5 years we've come a very, very long way in a supply chain where there was literally nothing. I think we've got so many things that are vital to our own company that I haven't spent a whole lot of time worrying about the things I can do nothing about, like Brexit and Scottish independence and all the rest of it. You know, we currently are trading with America and we're a small business and we do it. You know, it's, is it as easy as trading with the EU? No, but it's, you know, it's not that difficult. The hardest thing is when a tariff gets retrospectively put on your goods. This is what has happened recently, which you weren't expecting and weren't planning for. I mean, it's not a huge tariff, but it's only a few percent, but it's, you know, it's not something that we were expecting. But obviously, we're not French wine or whiskey or anything, which has been, or cheese, actually. I think we have a family in Ireland who are making Cashel Blue cheese, and they've been really hit because one of their biggest markets is the States, and they've got a massive tariff on their cheese now. So, you know, a free trade deal with the States would be great.
That was Fiona Houston, co-founder and CEO of Mara Seaweed. This series only works with your help. Let us know how your economy is doing at marketplace.org. Want to know what color you'll likely be seeing everywhere next year? Pantone knows. The company is best known for its color matching system that helps designers and artists around the world define and communicate color. But for 20 years now, Pantone has also named a color of the year. The choice for 2020 is classic blue. Here to talk about exactly what that means is Kasia St. Clair, author of The Secret Lives of Color. Kasia, welcome back to Marketplace.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on.
Well, as someone who writes about color and the role it plays in our lives, what do you make of this year's choice?
I think this choice, although the press release that came with it talked a lot about confidence and simplicity and the reflective nature of this particular blue, I also think it's a rather safe and possibly, dare I say it, even corporate choice. It's the
corporate
kind of blue... Yeah, it's the kind of blue that you can imagine being used in logos that of companies that might want you to hand over personal information. So banking logos, possibly, or social media logos. Broadly, what I've been seeing from people who care and are passionate about the Pantone color of the year, like people like me, is that roughly people feel the same. They feel it's quite commercial. They'll probably sell well, but that it's a little bit possibly of a misfire.
How would you describe this color? I was walking around the office. I realized it kind of looks like the color of recycling bins. How would you describe it?
That's a good way of putting it. So, you know, the people who love this color have talked about it like the color of the sky at dusk, just before it completely descends into night. I think it's kind of the imagined color of blueberries, not the actual color of blueberries, but the imagined color of blueberries. It's very close to navy blue, which actually, funnily enough, was selected by another company, Sherwin-Williams, as their color of the year 2020, which I thought was quite interesting.
But it also probably won't be lost on our listeners that 2020 is an election year here in the U.S. Pantone has picked a color with a certain political connotation. I mean, do you think that was intentional?
I don't. I think that in the language surrounding this choice, they've talked about it being reflective, confident, anchoring, and they've specifically wanted to go for something that isn't divisive, which was, again, one of the reasons why I felt this wasn't possibly, you know, the best choice, because inevitably, especially on social media, right after this was announced, there was a lot of talk about the blue wave. And I know that isn't what Pantone would have wanted to have fed into.
Apparently, classic blue isn't just a color. Pantone this year also created what they called a multi-sensory experience. What does that mean?
Well, usually when there is a color of the year, there are a raft of companies with whom Pantone partner in order to create products that people can buy that are this specific colour of the year. And this year they've gone a step further. They've really sort of thought about all your senses. So there's a tea that you can drink that is classic blue. There's a gin cocktail that actually looks rather nice that I'm sort of slightly tempted by that one. And then there's also a soundtrack. And this is the first time that Pantone have released a song that is meant to evoke the classic blue feeling. And what's interesting and I think is quite revealing is that it's meant to be quite a nostalgic track. And that's something that slightly bothers me about classic blue as a choice. It doesn't seem like a colour that is looking forward and that is open to the new challenges of a new decade. Instead, it feels like backward looking. And I think the soundtrack that has been chosen to illustrate classic blue is quite revealing in that it is quite nostalgic.
Kasia St. Clair talking about Pantone's colour of the year this year. Classic blue, or maybe as we're calling it, recycling bin blue. Kasia, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note on the way out, according to the Wall Street Journal, the average ticket price for the top 100 North American tours is now about $95, up 55% since the start of the decade. You can blame scalpers and profit-hungry promoters, but also our own listening habits. As piracy and streaming have reduced record sales, musicians are relying more on touring to make money. The decade's top grossing artist, by the way, according to Pollstar, was U2, with just over $1 billion in ticket sales. Full disclosure, some of it was mine. That's it. We gotta go. Today, the Dow rose 105 points, or 0.3%. The NASDAQ gained 69 points, almost 0.8%. And the S&P 500 added 16 points, 0.5%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. And I'm Amy Scott. See you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.